Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today, it's episode 121 with the title, Embracing Neurodiversity and Queer Identity. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Helen Davis. Helen supports neurodivergent adults and the organisations they are in. When I asked Helen to describe her superpower, she said she has both a superpower and some kryptonite. And she thinks that having ADHD has helped her live more than one life. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Really fantastic to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, brilliant. We've had a bit of trouble in the green room. We've been all over the place. We're into Zencaster, out of Zencaster, back into Zoom. So these never go smoothly, but welcome. I'm glad we finally can see and hear each other, which is amazing. So Helen, embracing neurodiversity and queer identities, tell me a bit more about what you do and how we can do that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of that specific point, I've noticed that there's a very, very high prevalence of neurodiversity within our queer communities. I'm not saying you have to be queer to be neurodiverse, but there tends to be a lot of people who are neurodiverse who are queer. And so I think that therefore, as well as all the colours of a rainbow and the various identities that we have, that is very much part of the intersection that we also have and share. And practical wisdom supports neurodivergent adults, as you said, and in all their glorious diversity, including about sex and gender as well, and sexual orientation. So I myself are gender fluid, and I think it's really important for our queer community to know that there are safe spaces to go where they can, you know, disclose about their neurodiversity and actually get some help if that's what they need.
You mentioned the intersection of neurodiversity, ADHD, ASD, and queerness is quite prevalent, you might say.
Yeah.
But I don't want to dive too much into talk about the CAS report because that's been said a lot. But that seems to conflate the issue as being if you have neurodiversity, then you're not genuinely gender dysphoric or trans. But you're saying There's you could be both, and it's not a problem.
You can easily be both, and and I'm part of the trans community, so I can very much consider both. And one didn't cause the other. I happen to be both.
There's a rabbit hole, isn't it? That whole CAS report.
I think my concern is having been lived in under Section 28. When I first came out, and I remember the repression. I remember you didn't know if you were queer, that you know if you get lose your job, you certainly wouldn't mention it at school. You'd get your head kicked in at certain places. You know, you had to really watch yourself. And I had thought we'd moved on decades, but it feels like literally that's reversing. And I guess I am very concerned for our trans young people who are having this level, I think, of institutional prejudice and transphobia, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, you work in the NHS or with the NHS and around the NHS.
Yeah.
We know that services are underfunded, they're stretched. Is it just that trans people have crept up stealthily and quickly and they're not geared up to support in the gender services.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I also should add as a caveat, I'm speaking as part of a person in the community rather than in my role.
Of course.
Yeah, that's an important distinction to make and caveat these days. But there's certainly a lot of, cuts these days and refocusing on what we're doing, trying to catch up post-COVID and all that kind of stuff. I think there's some fundamental philosophical differences. So if you're in the community and you want to, you feel it's your right and your choice to change, towards the body that you actually feel is actually your true self, that's a choice and a wish. And I think the trouble is a lot of the model in the gender services, there are more model which is about you have to prove that you're trans enough, that you want it enough, and you have to live a certain way for a certain amount of time, which isn't about choice. That's about proving you tick enough boxes to warrant that those procedures. And so that's like a fundamental philosophical difference of looking at it. And unfortunately, given the current CAS report and the other changes, it doesn't look like it will change towards what we would prefer, which would be us to have agency over our own bodies.
Yeah, I mean, we had the same with the Gender Recognition Act review, the Scottish one blocked by Section 35, the one that Theresa May tried to get going in 2018. It's kind of just at the point, I and maybe many others felt that the time was coming, the time was right. I thought, wow, it's looking optimistic. And then suddenly, the last 12 to 18 months.
And I think that's the hardest thing psychologically is it felt like we were getting somewhere, genuinely did. And then you're like, suddenly like the whole rug's been like whipped away and then some. And I know that people are very concerned about that. Equally, there's a lot of people in the healthcare profession who are very much, all for inclusion, on all levels, including about transgender services, who are wanting to make a difference, who are looking at inequalities. So health inequalities is also really actively being looked at. And actually, I'm a clinical director for transgender healthcare. And there's not a lot of, I don't know if there's anyone else who is. And, that's because, we very much care about health inequalities where I work as well. So I think there's much to do. It feels like it's an uphill battle. But there are places doing awareness training, trying to support people, putting in locally commissioned services for GPs for annual health checks, doing different, better initiatives to try and reassure the community that there are places where they can go and actually feel like they can get the care that they deserve. Because equally, I wouldn't personally want to go to any health practitioner who had a problem. It's mutual. No, I don't want to see them. They don't want to see me. And officially you would, no one would say that there are these practitioners who are transphobic. But I think we can see that, just as if we wish there wasn't other prejudices, there are going to be people in such a large workforce where that's going to be the case. But a lot of work is done to try and, say that's not acceptable. And I'm part of a group of people who 100% committed to make a difference to our trans community, as well as all the other people who need inclusion and deserve inclusion. So that's in terms of my healthcare side of things.
I'm a great believer that inherently people are good and inherently people feel they're doing the right thing. And that just because their view is different, have a different perspective, different lived experience, doesn't mean to say that they're a bad person. I think sometimes what we do is we jump to this polarized debate of you're over there and I'm over here. If you don't agree with me, I won't accept you. And if you don't agree with me, I won't accept you either. We end up being so far apart, we can't actually have conversations. I think that's what we're seeing in society at the moment, is this real polarization of perspectives. Yeah. And whilst forgetting that all people really want is for everyone to have a good life. And I guess people are worried, scared, confused, don't understand, whatever it may be.
All those things that you've also discussed, obviously, it's been issues like, you know, like I said, going back to Section 28, to the homophobia, to the AIDS pandemic that happened. You know, I remember those times vividly. I remember nursing the, you know, this really lovely patient who was sadly an AIDS victim, and he got a lot of homophobic. And I was there because back in the day, that basically the night staff weren't paying enough attention. So his partner paid for a private, you know, nurse to go and support his partner overnight. And there were completely misunderstandings. And back then, people worried that they're going to die from catching this. And, you know, back in the day, it was like seen as the gay disease initially and stuff like that. So, you know, sadly, these difficult times have been here at different points. But when we look at neurodiversity as well, people, you know, it's another area of where people can feel excluded, where people can feel different. And that's the crossover, isn't it? You know, sometimes you can feel like you don't fit in or you're not accepted for, and that there's some prejudice against you. And I, when I think back to my 20s, I can tell you now, there's no way I would have disclosed I'm dyslexic. I'd have thought I wouldn't get a job. A bit like I wouldn't have disclosed I was like queer. It's like, no, you're right. I needed work. No. So there were a couple of things you just didn't disclose, you know, or if you did, you did in like discreetly. And interestingly, I came out as being queer, you know, over the decades a lot quicker than I came out as being neurodivergent, because it genuinely felt career limiting for a very long time. And even now, you know, you speak to people, they are fearful. Some people have bad experiences when they come out of being judged, and some seem to find themselves suddenly being performance managed out of jobs. There's a lot of misunderstanding about neurodiversity and actually the benefits it can bring as well, you know. And so that's why, you know, I've really been avidly trying to address inequality all my life, obviously in healthcare, but I felt it was really important to deal with the inequality about being neurodivergent. When I worked at City University as a lecturer there, I made a point of saying I was a dyslexic tutor, because at that point, you know, it was, you knew that people might frown upon you if you said you're a teacher and dyslexic, you know? And so there are, I feel, when I look at the journey I've been both in the neurodivergent world and the queer world, there are so many synergies. There really are. And yeah, no. And so that's what Practical Wisdom is, particularly supporting people who are neurodivergent. But importantly, I also think the organisations, like you say, I agree with you. I don't think in people inherently bad. They might be misinformed, and I want to help raise awareness. I want to help, you know, help change people's perspective for the better, for inclusion all round, but particularly about the ND world.
You mentioned at the beginning you would call yourself queer, genderqueer, gender fluid.
Yeah,
people have heard the term trans woman. They've come into use to the term trans man. They didn't believe trans men existed until recently. You know,
yeah, I know. Weird.
Trans women are obvious. They spot us a mile off and then don't like us. So yeah. And we've heard about the term non-binary recently that, again, people are kind of not sure about. So how would you describe your gender fluidity? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because initially I was like, oh, I like non-binary. I'm not sure I have a particular, you know, gender I could either. And then I found, I was like, actually, no, probably gender fluid is actually a better description. The thing is that I'm 54. I'm not going to say I'm old, but I'm older. And back in the day, you didn't have all these different terms. You didn't have all these different labels. And I just kind of didn't think about it until many decades later. And then I was like, oh yeah, you know, and Brighton's got a very fantastic Brighton and Hove Trans Pride. And it made me really think about it when I got involved with that a little bit more. And I was like, oh, yeah, actually. But interesting, I also felt really shy. I did not want to come out again. I felt doing it once was fun enough. And I did know that whether it was non-binary or gender fluid, that like gender non-conforming was definitely me. I'd never felt that I was all one or the other. I just didn't. And we, you know, back in the day, we used to be called tomboys. And actually, in some ways, for me personally, that reflected the richness of having both genders, really, that I identified with. And that is how I do. feel now? Interestingly, if you go on websites and if you even go to different women's events, you're like, am I allowed anymore? You know, does that happen? I actually found I never used to worry about that. And I've been involved with women's rights and issues for like decades. And then now I find myself nervous. And unless I see that trans women are welcome, and so are people who still self-identify, you know, who are gender non-conforming, then I don't go. You know, I'm like, and I know that there's a subdivide in our own communities about things as well. And I've just found it's more complicated being gender fluid. Like, people don't know what to do with you. They just don't. Let alone which toilet you use to bait.
Oh, use that one at 10 o'clock in the morning, use that one at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's obvious, isn't it? Or whatever. Which one's free? Just pick a door.
Yeah.
So I remember talking to a young person, or you say young, early careers, sort of in their 20s, a couple of years ago, and they identified as non-binary. Mm. They were pretty supportive of the Women in Tech Forum in their organization and across the world. And they then got this message from the organizers or the people who ran it to say, we understand, you're now non-binary. Unfortunately, that means you're no longer allowed to represent us and speak on our stages because this is for women.
Yeah.
And we had a good chat about this. And I said, well, it really is a struggle. If you're assigned female at birth, mm-hmm. you still have an allegiance to, from a historic point of view, to the sensitivities of women. You understand some of the growing up issues that women have. Mm-hmm. And if you're assigned male at birth, it's really awkward. So if you're not careful, the women's network could welcome assigned male at birth people who are non-binary. If you said women and non-binary and gender fluid people are welcome within our network, then people get really freaked out. But you're not a woman enough.
Yeah.
If I let you in, someone who identifies as assigned male at birth could come in and stealth or something, and then take our space and kick us out. So it's really complicated, all this gender divide stuff, isn't it?
Very complicated, yeah. Yeah, and it's difficult. I mean, but it's not just that. Even if you think, for example, so I'm dating somebody who is a woman. So if I'm gender fluid, does that make me straight when I'm feeling masculine and a lesbian when I'm not? Do you know what I mean? It's like, do I change between that throughout the day? Other amusing things, like we have Father's Days and Mother's Days, and like my child was saying to me, but you're both, aren't you? Yeah. And they were like, oh, should I get you a Father's Day card? I went, why not? I said, because I do the work of both. Because a single parent, you certainly do. So it's just interesting because things are so binary that you regularly do not fit in so many boxes.
But there are people, as we know, out who are trying to enforce the rigidity of this binary. And I understand it. Yeah. As a woman myself, I understand how women have had to overcome oppression, marginalization, discrimination, less opportunities. So there's a real desire to make sure that we don't lose what it is to be a woman.
Yeah.
In all of this, so that we lose the momentum of equality and equity that we still lack in society. So it's trying to balance that, isn't it? That's a real struggle.
Yeah, and I know because I have heard people with their different perspectives as to, you know, what they think about that and how hard fought it was to gain any grounds on women's rights, you know. And I know that that's felt very strongly in certain sectors. And I think that that's very difficult because I don't want to diminish the struggles that people had. But equally, I will, or, you know, trans women are women. That's my point of view. I'm not changing that. And like you said, we're going to have opposing views with some people. And I guess it's how we deal with those opposing views.
Yeah. And the government don't help, but you don't need to comment on that, obviously. But it's
yep,
it is. It's just a struggle at the moment. It's opening the paper, you know, scrolling through news reports on your phone. It's everywhere. So yeah, Can we talk a bit about your neurodivergence? How did you? I mean, you obviously realized at some point in your life you were queer, gender fluid, trans, however you want to describe yourself. At some point in your life, when did you first kind of figure out that neurodiversity was a thing as well? Was that kind of early on?
Well, yeah. So even in primary school, I knew I found things tricky, and I think my dad even had a chat with a teacher and said, you know, I think my daughter is, you know, dyslexic. And they went, yeah, probably. And they were like, but we don't like to pigeonhole kids. So therefore they didn't. So we did, there was no assessment. I got extra lessons, which they called remedial lessons. Lovely title. And so I was that, you know, special education needs kid at primary school. And I went to secondary school, and when they moved, they were like, oh, let's not put her in grammar school. She won't do very well and she'll struggle. So then they put me in the comprehensive, which fine by me, by the way. But, and so I went there, and I remember being in the bottom set for everything, but getting the classes really quickly and then sitting there bored for hours, like so long. And all my school reports said would do better if they applied themselves or didn't daydream, you know, but actually it was so boring because I got it really fast. I just couldn't write it very clearly. I didn't know how to access my written side of things, and it's sequencing as well. It's not just about spelling mistakes. I actually understand things fast. The kind of writing it down and saying it back to you in a linear fashion has taken a lot of work because my thinking I used to joke, I don't even think straight. So my thinking is all over the place, but I can actually make connections that other people can't, you know? Yeah, so it was interesting. I didn't actually get my dyslexia diagnosis until my mid-20s when I went to night school for a higher national certificate in business and finance, and they did an assessment then. And even before the assessment, they were like, oh, we don't think you're that dyslexic, but, you know, let's do the assessment. And then she just came out, she went, oh, actually, you're very dyslexic, because the threshold of how I was achieving to what I could be achieving was huge. So the higher the frustration zone, the more it is a disability, basically, because you're not reaching your potential, whatever that be for you. But at that point, I'd already passed my nursing exams. And I can tell you now, I only got into nursing because there was an entrance test. I had bugger all qualifications. I didn't do very well at school. I got in on an entrance test by a winning and a prayer. And then I was with this fantastic nursing set, many of them from Southern Ireland. And we just talked. We talked all the time about all the conditions, about what we were learning. And I didn't know that all those chats were helping me pass my exams, because I can tell you reading was doing nothing. It wasn't retaining at all. But I could recall all those conversations. And that's how I managed to pass my nursing. And if that not happened, I wouldn't be here with you now.
I'm not a big reader. I found that I was, if I tried to read a novel or a non-fiction or a fiction or something, I'd be reading the page and I get to the bottom of the second page and I go, I haven't got a clue what I just read. I could read the words, but it just wasn't going in.
Yeah.
But I can read technical or things that are nonfiction where I'm looking for instruction or looking stuff up or reference information, because my eyes are able to scan the page really, really quickly, lock on to what I'm trying to find and go, right, got it. I can extract data out of pages very quickly, but I can't read all the fluff. It's just like, just get me to the paragraph I need. So I can relate to that. Yeah, reading just doesn't work for me either, really.
No, and I mean, now you have to read all the time for everything. So I read when I have to, and I got taught how to speed read. So you can pick up, do what you said, but I had to be taught that. And that did help, but it doesn't help me retain it for ages or anything like that. You know, I have to really work at that. But luckily, you know, starting off a career in nursing, because this week it's 36 years being a nurse. Yeah. So I was like, you know, I learned by doing. You know,
most of my career has been emergency care, which really fits with an ADHD profile as well, because we love drama, we love excitement. And so that's, it works then, you know, because I'm on adrenaline, I'm excited, you're kind of going to the next things, you're purpose driven, you know, you're literally about trying to save as many lives as you can, you know, making a difference. So I didn't realize, and it was sheer luck, that actually being in the NHS was the best thing for my neurospicy brain going.
So basically, it's all this stimulation and stuff.
Yeah.
High adrenaline, then downtime, then high adrenaline again. Sort of.
Yeah. And I loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved it. I was, you know, you buzz. You properly buzz. It's exciting. It's really interesting. But also, any good department is actually well organized. So it's not just, you also have to be able to organize at a high level, like your patients. And some of my roles were quite senior, where you were overseeing like bed management for an entire hospital, and then the cardiac arrest bleep would go and you'd have to, in the middle of that, go and respond to a cardiac arrest and then pick up again, getting back to the bed allocations. So, you know, you had to also be able to understand enough structure and organizing, as well as the kind of the more physical ailments of healthcare.
I noticed from reading some of the show notes that you put together for me in advance, You mentioned imposter syndrome, and tell me how that manifests. Is that so, in your gender, in your identity? Is that in your neurodiversity? Neurospiciness, or is it everything?
It's in a lot of things, like being a parent. Am I effing it up? I really worry about, feel guilty for nearly everything. But so for example, in my, you know, clinical work, I'm a clinical director, and I'm actually gone up the scale. We have these band things, and it goes 9 and then it goes higher. And I'm higher than a 9, which only, there's not that many of us in the country, really. So I'm a pretty senior nurse. I still think I'll be found out soon. and you kind of, you just think, oh, you know, and you like, well, maybe there's like nothing special about me and anyone could do this job. And you kind of think, I mean, I forever feel grateful for where I am, but you kind of worry, did you earn it? You know, did you do enough to get where you are? Yeah, there's a bit of worry about that. And, you know, bearing in mind, I now like run a neurodivergent support company. You know, it took me a couple of years to feel confident enough to call myself an expert, because I was like, but there's so many other people who know so much more about it than me. You know, what if I don't know enough? Luckily, now we've helped a few hundred people and we got really good feedback. I'm like, oh, it's okay. Maybe I'm all right. So it's things like that.
It's not always about knowing everything, though, is it? I mean, I always say that I don't have to know everything, as long as I've got a method or a methodology. Mm. And people often describe me as considered and measured, because I've got a brain that will think about sequences and how I will achieve something. I don't have to know everything. I've got a phone, I've got Google, I've got other stuff. I can assimilate lots of information and rationalize it and give an opinion that I believe in. So, and I respect other views as well. So I think if you balance all that in, you don't necessarily need to be an expert in everything, you just have to know one thing more than somebody else, is what I was saying.
And I think because my whole life has been lived experience being neurodivergent, you know, I got a psychology and counseling degree, you know, people have been my hyper-focus. Like I said, that's 36 years of working with people, you know, I'm qualified lecturer as well. You know, I've actually done quite a lot of things that really help make me a good coach and trainer. And so I do now feel quite comfortable saying I'm actually really good at running workshops. And like you said, I don't need to know everything, but what I can do is I know the things in terms of what to deliver about the awareness, the common struggles that people have, the common things that help people. And you can take people on a journey, because it's about the people before you. It's not like, you know, all about me. You know, the whole point is it's about supporting them and their understanding. And, you know, when you've got one in five or one in seven people who are neurodivergent, you can guarantee wherever I go, there's going to be a few people out there. Whether they disclose or not is another thing. So it's about creating safe environments for people to feel that they can actually talk about it, or they can say they know somebody and what these issues are, so that they're more out in the open. And that's my gift, because I genuinely I'm accepting, non-judgmental, and care. You know, I want to create these environments, and I want to support people be empowered to thrive, whatever that looks like for them.
Yeah, I get that. I was at a conference the other week, and I was chatting to this this lady over coffee, and just chatting away. And towards the end of the conversation, she said, "Oh, and I'm neurodivergent. If you hadn't noticed, I had noticed. We've been chatting for 15 minutes, I haven't said a word yet." You were just going for it and all over the place. She's a wonderful person, wonderful conversation. And yeah, and it's, if you let people speak, let people share the stories about themselves, you find out huge amounts. I mean, which is one of the reasons I love doing this podcast, is I can have conversations with people I'd never have a conversation with. But yeah, imposter syndrome, it's, I think I've been doing this role now for about 8 years.
Mm.
And I transitioned about 7.5-8 years ago. And I think in the early days, I had this massive imposter syndrome about saying the word "we," as in "we women," or talking about it, you know, as an inside rather than an outside. And that took me ages. And I still, when I say those sort of things, I still have this kind of looking around me if I'm in public. Going, did anyone give me a funny look by saying that? So I'll probably never get rid of that. But being in the EDI space, again, it's just every day you improve, you continue your learning. When you look over your shoulder, you look back and think, wow, 7 years ago, blimey, I've come a long way. But you look down at your feet, you think, I haven't moved. And it's that kind of thing, isn't it? And as you say, believing people are going to call you out, they're far better than me, they're far good. Yeah, then you just realize it's all fluff and bluster on social media. They're just the same as I am. Yeah. They're trying to figure it out as well. So
there's a lot of trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, having seen you talking in the public spaces, I mean, like, I really love your approach, and your story is so compelling, you know. So I'm really glad that you're in the space where you are in EDI and you are sharing those things. And you, like, particularly you can bring, like you said, that open to a conversation about it to help people, you know, along their understanding journey. So I think that's very powerful, really.
Yeah, because people are also scared of getting it wrong, aren't they? I mean, you must, as a neurodivergent person, gender fluid person, a queer person, people must be really kind of wary around you. Almost like hyper kind of concerned about, did I get that right?
Yeah, you can definitely. It was interesting. I have been in some meetings where we're trying to look at different inequality stuff, and people, like proper nervous and almost saying nothing because they don't want to say something and get it wrong, and being really worried about that. And that's unfortunate, because if people are that worried, then, you know, that's all that they're focusing on instead of the difference that they could make, because they're open to thinking a certain way, and they could actually make changes that are more welcoming or make a difference to the client group that they're actually, you know, feeling a bit nervous about getting it wrong for.
That reminds me, when we started talking before I pressed the record button, I was saying, just checking your pronouns. And you just sort of shrugged your shoulders at me and said, any. And I went, how can I work with any? I said, she. And he went, that's fine. They, that's fine. I thought, you mean I have to make the decision about the pronouns I use? Yeah. I went, well, okay, then I'll go with she. That's fine if you're happy with that. And it was then, so I wasn't nervous about asking you. I was kind of bouncing with the call. It wasn't a problem, but I can imagine people who are less used to those type of conversations would have been really kind of like, oh my God, what do I do now?
Yeah. And if you're being particularly cruel, you could bounce it around. That would be quite funny, but I haven't.
But yeah, it's like
she, they,
and see what happens. Just confuse people. Yeah, I genuinely don't mind actually. So yeah, but that, you know, obviously it's such a personal thing, isn't it? Because also, you know, I got friends who, and you know, sometimes they're identifying as they and she, and other times it's just they, and that, you know, it can flex. So even with the same person, I think you can be on a journey that it literally can be fluid as well. So just checking in is always handy, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's always good to ask. I've got a professional friend who I've only known as a woman, and then probably a couple of years ago they announced on Facebook or LinkedIn that they were non-binary, they them pronouns, and I've got a lot of friends who know this person, and it's really confusing for them because they knew them before in their previous life and their birth life. So they've gone through a transition from male to female to non-binary, and they, not all of them have got the memo about the non-binary. So yeah, they're still proud of themselves getting it right for saying she when they've known them as he. And it's and I'm sort of correcting and doing this thing, and it's like you can see people look at me go, yeah, what? It's like the brains are being blown out, and it is kind of tricky for people outside of our echo chamber, isn't it?
Well, it depends. I thought that, but if you speak to any 20-year-olds, they don't find it tricky.
Well, yeah.
I also think there's a certain threshold in the ages. Like we're making a meal of it. But actually the 20s, like they nip in and out of all that language and have even more expanded language about it that, you know, I mean, I'm never going to be cool with the kids in general. So, but that, you know, that they really don't have the same complexities we do about it. They just don't, which is
a lot of it's learned behavior, socialization, that colonialism, religion, all those kind of things. We can blame everybody, blame the Romans.
It's all the Romans, yeah.
The Romans, yeah. What have they ever done for us? That's Monty Python. Yeah, I don't think our average listener has probably heard of Monty Python, if they're switching Gen Z. So you mentioned, I don't want to pry, but you mentioned you got a family, and you mentioned about your, not only are you queer in terms of identity, but then that means your sexuality becomes a kind of a moving target as well. And I often joke with my wife about this as well, because it doesn't really matter to us, you've got a census form, you've got to tick a box, you know, which is why I tend to use pansexual, because it means I don't have to tell you anything. It just means that anything's possible. My wife tends to use bisexual, but only because it makes more sense to most people that she's a woman who was married to a man who's now married to a woman. And it allows them to go, okay, I get it now, without calling herself a lesbian, because she's not. Yeah. Really, she's also bi, because she'll ogle the rock on telly as much as she will me, if you like. So she's kind of open to all interactions. But yeah, it's really hard when you try and map this into a two dimensional scale, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is as well, because even in chats that I've had with like my partner, and they're like, oh, so what do you? Is it okay to say we're girlfriends, you know, or what other term? And then we kind of went, well, because, you know, kind of partner straight off on a few first few dates sounds a bit too heavy. Do you know what I mean? So there's this whole, it's like, oh, I don't know, you know. And then because there isn't quite the language, or if it is, it for me, like, it just felt a bit odd. I think somebody said something like, you can have like they friend or something, and I just for
they
me
friend that, or
like,
them friend
and I was like nah, but you know, but for someone else that might fit. But it was such a weird conversation to have, so I don't think the language has caught up, but like you said, it's a tricky one to navigate. And it's interesting in terms of when you say about socialization, I was trying to explain to like my child the other day, you know, I can't remember how it came up, but I said, oh yeah, when I was younger, I did get a bit of issues for being a lesbian. He was like, why? I don't get it. Why were they mean? And of course like they've not come across that yet. You know, they don't understand that at primary school age. And like, well, why would you do that? Why would you exclude people or treat people different? And they're like, oh, that doesn't sound very nice. And it's interesting, the ideas of young children, you know, where they are in this, you know, they're until they're socialized, they're kind of not, they just don't see it as an issue.
Yeah, that phrase, isn't it? Hate is a learned behavior. It's not inherent. We have biases and safety mechanism, protectionism, and all this kind of thing. But to actually weaponize it is a learned behavior, isn't it? It's not not inherent.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely. But it is quite interesting, though, is the other things that is quite in terms of neurodiversity as well. There are different family norms on that as well. So you might have an entire neurospicy household, but if they haven't bothered to have a diagnosis for whatever reason, they may not identify as that. And then you'll have other people who, you know, realize that their child has just been diagnosed with ADHD. And then like, oh, I have all those traits. Oh, does that mean I am? Because there's a lot of people from 30 plus who didn't equally have that language or that level of interest when we were at school, you know? And so that's also changed over the decades as well. And so you've got a lot of people who are realizing because the members of their family or friends are getting diagnoses and they realize that they've got a lot of those traits that actually maybe they have that as well. So that's quite interesting because it's quite common for whole families to be neurodiverse, to be honest. Mm. There is a hereditary element to it.
I'm certainly probably more... Is there equivalent of gaydar for neurodiverse? Endar or something?
Endar.
I'm kind of...
I haven't seen it yet, though.
I'm kind of more hyper-aware when I'm around people thinking, there's some certain characteristics and certain ways of speaking, certain ways of interacting and doing and all this. I think it's probably ASD or some level of autism. And you think, and then you don't bother mentioning it. And then you just learn to put that into your little tool set in your head saying, okay, that I need to make sure that I'm explaining things differently or just be prepared or we're going to have a conversation differently and or be prepared for a bit of hyper-focus or a bit of randomness going on here.
Yeah.
But is there such a thing as this neurotypical we talk about, you know, this bell curve of normality where the actual normal bit is so narrow, is everybody's on kind of some sort of divergent spectrum somewhere, aren't they? I mean, everyone could be.
I think everybody is different, but I think people who are neurotypical is a term obviously where it's the majority of the population. So when it's still 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 who aren't, then they're the people who are either side of the curve, basically, in terms of whatever normal is. And so the other thing is to think about is like to get a diagnosis, you have to have a full suite of the traits. So you could have some neuro traits, but if you don't have a full suite, you don't win the lucky ND prize of that label. But you could still be struggling. So for example, I do we're supporting people who are on the waiting list for autism and ADHD assessments. We're supporting one of the Kent organisations. And the top 4 issues that both autistics and ADHD have is planning and organising, is attention and focus, harnessing emotions, and also managing sleep. They're the really highly prevalent problems. That doesn't mean that other people in the population do not have those challenges, but those are very common difficult traits that they share, which is why we aimed at those particular traits. So I've also stepped away. It's like, I think labels are useful for heuristics, but I make it a bit more simple. If you're struggling with this and you want some support, that's what we do, you know, so that you can do it by the challenge rather than a label.
You talk about the full suite, and I appreciate that, as you say, the bell curve has upper quartile, upper percentile, and lower percentile, and the people in the middle. And it's extremely difficult, as you say, to get the full suite. You know, the occasional chair, the sofa, and the footstool to get your diagnosis. But the waiting lists are incredibly long at the moment, aren't they?
God, yeah. Yeah, that's a really, really big challenge, which is why fair play to NHS Kent, because they're actually doing something about supporting people while they're on the waiting list. Because unfortunately, the need has massively outstripped like the services that like significantly, and that's everywhere up and down the country. So that is also being looked at national level. But in the meantime, I think it's really good that places like NHS Kent are actually supporting their communities and offering things to support the waiting list as well. So I think, you know, applaud what they're doing. But yes, the astronomical waiting lists. Yeah.
So what worries me is that a lot of people are going undiagnosed. A lot of people are living suspecting, as you say. I've met several people who ended up going through diagnosis because their child was being diagnosed.
Yeah.
And then as that process came to light, listening to how the physician was talking to this person around their diagnosis, they went, hang on a minute, that's me as well. That's me as well. That's me as well. So
yeah,
we've got lots of older generation who are just coming out now, aren't they?
Yes, they really are. They really are. And it's really quite a big thing for people. And, you know, it doesn't stop there. When you actually find out you are, there's also a sense of loss of what could have happened and didn't, or what should have happened, for example. So there's a grieving process with it too, because you suddenly think, if I had help, what would have my life been like? You know, so that can also happen as well. And yeah, so it can be a tricky one. And sometimes it can feel like it gets worse before it gets better, because also having a diagnosis isn't the same as actually having support. You know, once you know where your specific issues are, then you can target that to try and get the support that you need. So actually the diagnosis does one thing, but actually you're then on a journey to try and think about what things would help you specifically.
Yeah. I often think, I don't know if this is the wrong way, right way of looking at it. I think if you look at our prehistoric evolution, when was writing and mathematics a requirement in you know, living in those times, you know, I think, well, surely the weird ones are the people who can read and write and spell, because that's kind of a learned behavior. And who says being able to read and write is our human norm? Communication obviously is, but yeah, you know, we have people who are artistic, they cave paint. We have people who are accurate, they can throw a spear straight. We have people who are good at nurturing. We have people who are good at this. And I think society is trying to create these constructs of normality. And again, we're trying to fit people into these little boxes. And again, I'm not trying to get anything away from someone who is neurodivergent or ND or whatever their superpower or super spiciness is. But we want to fit people into defined spectrums of things rather than just saying, okay, you don't read and write that great, but hey, wow, you're an amazing person doing this, and this, which is what we often miss, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, you hit the nail on the head about inclusivity. What if we actually just talk about that difference is normal, to be expected, you know, that actually we're looking at what people's strengths are, the things that they find tricky, you know, and that we're just kind of managing to get everyone to not just thrive, but also work in harmony with each other to do the thing, whatever it is they're trying to do at work or at home, or, you know, that actually it's embraced, because, you know, the whole point is about communities. That's what we did have in the cave times, you know, working together towards a common goal. And surely working towards together like a common goal, like sustainability, for example, is definitely worthwhile, rather than having many, many labels and divisory approaches.
Yeah, I suppose our humanity, though, is all about biases and stereotypes and our brain functions, how we process stuff, isn't it? So as much as we can sit back here and be enlightened, I know that I'm a judgmental person, the same as everybody else. It's what you do with that judgment that matters, isn't it? How do you put that judgment filter in? How do you stop it coming out of your mouth or stopping it occupying your brain?
And you can have unconscious bias, for sure. I guess, you know, yeah, it's having some awareness and that you might have an unconscious bias that, you know, that you can think about, you know, inclusivity and what you're actively doing to embody it in the workplace, for example, or the club. It doesn't always have to be just the workplace. You know, there's plenty of other organisations that we are involved with and institutions. So, yeah, I think it's just having awareness of those things. And actually, the function sometimes of these labels, which is the other need for it, is that it's a heuristic. It's a way of describing things. You know, stereotypes are there for a reason, because there's a collection of things that come together that help, in one word, help. You know, I say the word ADHD, then people get a rough idea that that person's probably impulsive, might be a bit late for meetings, or, you know, there'll be certain characteristics that people associate with that term. And so it does have a function in terms of that perspective. One of the things I think is important, though, is how you also find each other, how you find your tribe. Because if you feel like you're the only person, you know, not just the only gay in the village, but the only ND in the village, then you can feel very alone, and it can feel very difficult. And you almost feel like you're weird and not validated in who you are. One of the biggest outcomes that we had from our coaching that we did over the last, you know, 6 months plus, was that people felt validated and heard. And that they actually, some of their ways of coping were actually completely fine and actually really good and useful for them to use. I mean, the other thing that I'm wanting to launch, and we are launching from middle next month, so mid-May, is we are launching something called the Neurodivergent Champion Scheme. And I'm really excited about that, because that's the whole idea, is that you can have neurodivergent people who are championing, happy to be visible. You can have allies who are happy to be visible, and that there's an emblem that goes with it, and they can put that on their web page, whatever their organization is. They can like put it on their footer if it's just an individual, you know, wherever they want to display it. And then you can actually know that that person is, you know, ND or ND friendly. And if you can approach them, because then you actually know that you feel safe, because like I said, a lot of people don't feel like they can be out, and then they actually got a safe place to go. So that's something that we're also going to have a charter that people sign up to, but that's something we're launching, yeah, very soon, because I think it's important for there to be visibility and for there to be role models and for people you can approach when you're, you know, not sure in your journey.
It's kind of like the pronouns. It's kind of like,
yeah,
the flag. And we've also got the sunflower lanyards and things as well, haven't we? Where we have, yeah, people. So it's allowing people, it's signposting for allies to, yeah, be an ally, to know where your safe spaces are,
yeah,
and to help people interact with you in a more positive way, I guess.
Yeah. And the sunflower is great, because like you can wear that, the lanyards and everything, to say like, I need help, or be aware that there's a, you know, there's an issue that might be a hidden disability. So I think that's got a really important function. Many of my friends use that as well. I think the Neurodivergent Champion Scheme is kind of akin, but different to that, because it's actually saying, I'm proud, I'm neurodiverse, come here.
You can't see this, listeners, because I've got my sunflower leggings on today. And these actually have a charitable donation when you buy them as well, to support the cause.
Very good.
But it is. I think. This is what kind of worries people who are kind of not in the club, you know, not in the not in the inner circle, not in the echo chamber of EDI and neurodiversity and in gender diversity, whatever it may be, with disability, is that this go back to this fear of getting it wrong. There's all this language, there's all these protocols, there's all this kind of signposting that goes on and say, hang on a minute, what about me? I've got needs as well, and it all seems to be, as they, and I'm sorry for this language, but pandering to the minorities is kind of, we hear this all the time, don't we? And it's not pandering. It's just going, how can I show you respect? How can I understand who you are? What can I do to help? I think that's called equity, isn't it? Equity. Yay.
Yeah, exactly.
But the new generation, the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, as you said, they kind of got all this stuff. They got it off pat, and they almost do it like a little bio. Is when they meet each other, they go, hi, I'm Jake, I'm trans, non-binary, neurodiverse, ADHD, and Asperger's, and this and the other thing. And they think, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, fine. Yeah. And I often equate it to, if you're old enough to remember, modems. We used to dial up the internet, yeah? Because they used to get this screeching noise, didn't they? That was all this protocol of establishing how fast they could speak to each other, if there's error correction, all these kind of things. Yeah. And so that's what we're doing. Yeah, the younger guys are now sort of doing this little screechy noise to each other, going, okay, I got it now. We can now communicate. And us Gen Z, I'm a Gen X, boomers and later millennials are, it's kind of still trying to connect at 1900 and the baud rate's wrong.
And I think that's part of the language evolving as well, isn't it, over time? You know, which is why, you know, 30 plus is caught on the back foot and beginning to catch up.
I'm starting to feel more in common with my mum these days than I do Gen Z's. Because I've kind of got used to being with my mum. I mean, how old am I? I'm not far off 60, so I've lived a fair bit and been through a fair few things. But yeah, and I find it refreshing though, just the younger generation, the attitude of society, the way it's evolving.
Mm.
I kind of warm to it. It's where I want to be. I want to be 50 years younger again. Have another go. This world is getting better every year.
Yeah, no, I do love the approach, and when you speak to people, it's really great. And you know, yeah, it's really good. Not just the Brighton Bubbles that does that.
No. So you got, as well as being a clinical director, band nine upwards, you know, one of the few in the country. So you got your own. Is it a charity? Practical Wisdom? Is it a charity or CIC?
It's not for profit. So yeah, everything gets plowed back in. Yeah.
Brilliant. And so, do you want to just give us an update about what it does and how people can get hold of you and interact?
Yeah. So we currently do a couple of things. So we support people on the waiting list, and we can also support organisations as well with particularly neurodiverse challenges. So we can run groups or do evergreen products that support things like managing attention and focus, planning and organising. Like I said, the harnessing emotion, not many one are doing that one. And also, you know, harnessing sleep, which is, you know, a little tricky to improve your sleep at times. So, yeah, so we help with those. We've got a few other courses coming online as well. So there's that aspect, which is about supporting people, neurodiverses individually to thrive. So that's like our ND Thrive suite. And then obviously I do public speaking and awareness. I also do something that's for teams, which is about an organization trying to get the best harmony they can out of their teams that is neuroinclusive. Because actually when people aren't disclosing, if we make it a bit more neuroinclusive all round, they win, but also you can enhance productivity overall. So that's kind of the natural rhythm thing we do. And lastly is the Neurodivergent Champions Scheme. It's free and you can be completely involved with that. If you as an individual, your club or your organization is interested in that and you're happy to sign up to the charter, then you're very, very welcome to be a part of that when we're launching that from mid-May. And you can contact us on hello@practicalwisdom.uk. There's no co, so it's hello@practicalwisdom.uk. And we're more than happy to help you.
You're on LinkedIn, so Helen Davis. That's Davis with an IES at the end.
That's it, yeah.
Written Davies, but pronounced Davis. Helen Davis, Practical Wisdom, and superstar NHS above level 9, clinical director.
Yeah, who only got there because of all the help they got. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to get caught out one day and you'll hold your head in shame for being just you. Sorry, I'm just me. That's okay. Helen, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to have a conversation with you today.
It's been an absolute joy and so lovely to be able to talk to you. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change.
Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.